of papers written with Sofra Aharoni, Eva Silverstein, Mina Ganagich, Chris Bean, building on lots of work done with other people, and inspired by this paper by Dino. So, I mean, you all know this, even though probably there aren't so many phenomenologists here. One of the central mysteries that we're struggling with is the so-called hierarchy problem, the dimensionless ratio of the weak to the Planck scale, which is about 10 to the 16. And about a year from now, we'll probably find out what it is that explains this ratio, if there is an explanation. Most of us, at least in the string theory community, would probably bet on low-energy supersymmetry, though it's far from a certain bet.
The next best guess is?
I think probably actually the best guess was Technicolor. It just seems to have trouble with data. But anyway. Okay, now the reason people like Susie, of course it stabilizes the hierarchy, it has two additional nice features that come along for free that are suggestive. One is if you take the gauge couplings in the standard model, run them up according to the renormalization group, and ask whether they meet, well, two lines always cross. Three lines generically don't, and in the standard model, indeed, they don't. But if you just add the minimal superpartner content, alpha 1 and alpha 2 cross, and they correctly retrodict the QCD coupling constant. So unification seems to be consistent with supersymmetry. And then the other free feature is that supersymmetry would explain another a priori unconnected mystery, which is the mystery of why 25% of the energy content of the universe is dark matter. So if you have Susie breaking at the intermediate scale, mediated by some kind of gravitational strength effects, together with R parity, which is necessary anyway for Susie to be realistic, then the lightest supersymmetric particle is always a stable dark matter candidate with almost the right freeze-out abundance without any futzing or tuning. Now, I should say that although Susie makes the hierarchy radiatively stable, in order to really explain the small ratio, not just claim that it's stable, you need a natural mechanism that explains why Susie broke at an exponentially small scale. So the dimensionless way to say this is there's an order parameter, an F term, that breaks Susie. There's M Planck. And even with the highest possible Susie breaking scale that makes a natural theory, this dimensionless ratio is 10 to the 16. So if you just declare there's a small F term, it's radiatively stable, but you haven't made real progress. Now, Witten, of course, proposed a mechanism, maybe others did too, that could explain the small number instead of just postulating it many years ago in 1981. So this will be very elementary. I'll go through it. Let's imagine a supersymmetric field theory with some chiral multiplets. So the structure is there's a lowest component scalar, a fermion, and a theta squared times an F. Then the Lagrangian in supersymmetry with n equals 1 takes the form of an integral over all of superspace of a Kähler function and an integral over half of superspace of a holomorphic function of the chiral fields of the superpotential. Of course, this is just the two derivative action, but that's good enough for us. And, of course, there could be gauge fields present. I'll assume that they are present, but I'm not going to write out all the supermultiplets because I'd have to go through fixing the Wessimino gauge and so forth. Now, the point of this is that there were very powerful non-renormalization theorems proved by people like Grisaru and Rochek in the 70s and then explained kind of in more hand-waving and simple ways by holomorphy arguments in the 80s and 90s that let one show that in wide classes of theories, the superpotential is not renormalized to all orders in perturbation theory. So half of the action I wrote, the superpotential, is some tree-level thing, and then it receives corrections of order e to the minus 1 over g squared, where g is some coupling constant. Now, that doesn't mean that the scalar potential isn't corrected, because the scalar potential, while it is a sum of dw d phi squared, there's really a Kähler metric here contracting the f's. But nevertheless, it gives you unusual degrees of control over also the scalar potential. So Witten's point was you could hope to build models where the following was true. To all orders in perturbation theory, the vacuum, or all of the vacuum of the theory, have vanishing F-terms. That is, there's a supersymmetric vacuum. But these non-perturbative corrections to the superpotential could give rise to one or more non-supersymmetric vacua with F non-zero. And then the point was it would then be natural to expect that since the F-term is arising from a non-perturbative effect, F is of order e to the minus 1 over g squared, which would naturally be much smaller than M Planck squared. And this is the same way that, of course, QCD gets its small dimensional transmutation scale. So if that were true, it would explain the small number. And then in particular, however this breaking was mediated to the standard model, the protection of the Higgs mass would really have been explained. So this was proposed 25 years ago. Immediately there was realization that this was a really good idea, and there was a search for examples, which was very time consuming. It required a lot of non-trivial developments in field theory, but within 4 or 5 years, examples were found. I think the first example is by Affleck, Dine, and Zyberg. And I think it's fair to say, even after 25 years, typical examples that do this, that dynamically break supersymmetry, are rather complicated. There's been recent advances, for instance, the ISS-like models, but even these simplest models really involve multiple small scales that need to be explained in some full theory, like string theory. Now, of course, obviously one way that you could do dynamical supersymmetry breaking in string theory is you make a DSB gauge theory on brains or in the heterotic V8, and then you embed it into a string compactification. This is a very common sense thing to do. And many people have worked on that, including me. But here I want to propose an alternative. Okay, I want to point out that many string models actually dynamically break supersymmetry in a way that you wouldn't have foreseen by studying non-trivial gauge dynamics. That is, in a way that involves no non-abelian gauge dynamics at all. So I'm going to go back to the start of this subject and just sort of give a primer on Susie breaking, and then we'll see that string theory does something really funny with these simplest models to make them actually somewhat realistic. So the simplest models of Susie breaking you can imagine, the place you should start, are the ones that were discussed in the 70s, the Polonyi model, the Faye model, and the O'Rafferty model. So I'll just go through these. So what's the Polonyi model? It's the simplest model you can imagine because to whatever real field content you want, you just add one more field, a chiral superfield X. And you imagine the Kalor potential for X. I mean, after all, this is a free theory of a scalar field, basically. So it's X dagger X plus some corrections that involve high scale physics and are suppressed. But you write down a superpotential that's just mu squared X. Okay, so why did Polonyi do this? Well, if the superpotential is linear in X, then dW dx will be non-zero, and Susie will be broken. So naively, this theory breaks supersymmetry with an F-term of order mu squared. Now, of course, this is a little bit of a fake. In this leading approximation, the scalar potential is exactly flat, which is never going to be something that remains true in a non-supersymmetric theory unless there's a shift symmetry, which is absent. So in this approximation, the theory has a non-supersymmetric moduli space of degenerate vacua. And since a priori in various completions that would couple this to the standard model, for instance, this moduli space is not protected by any symmetry, it's a fake. So the fate of this theory actually depends on how this moduli space is lifted, which actually means we need to know about the dot, dot, dots in the Kalor potential. Now, if the leading correction that's induced by whatever ultraviolet physics you have at scale m is given by some term that looks like x dagger x squared over m squared, which is something you'd kind of generically expect just based on the symmetry structure, then for one sign of the coefficient of this quartic term, you would actually obtain a stable supersymmetry breaking vacuum at the origin if you just work out the Kalor metric. Well, for the other, there's a runaway to very large values of x. That doesn't mean the theory is necessarily sick, but it means our analysis is incorrect. You'd have to re-expand at large x. Now, my point here is that if you could justify Polonyi's linear superpotential with a very small value of mu squared, that is, if you could really find an example where mu squared was much less than m funk squared, this would in many ways be a perfectly respectable model of Susie breaking. On the other hand, Witten didn't propose this model because this is a free scalar theory. The scalar is clearly not going to have instanton effects that generate a small mu squared, and so this doesn't look like a dynamical or reasonable thing to do. Now, I want to introduce the next simplest model, which fixes one of the defects of the Polonyi model. This is called the Faye model, and it's only slightly more complicated. So the field content here, how do we complicate life? Well, we should add a U1 gauge multiplet, and then if we want any charges, we have to add a pair to avoid anomalies. So the field content is a U1 gauge multiplet and two chiral multiplets of charge plus and minus. And then the lowest gauge invariant superpotential we can write is just M phi plus phi minus. Now, U1 gauge fields are special in supersymmetry because you can add a Phi Eliopoulos term to the action. So we'll add, imagine adding such a Phi Eliopoulos term with coefficient R that just multiplies the auxiliary field and the gauge multiplet. So then the full potential, including the D term, will be, well, here's dW d phi squared, and here's the D term. And it's a fact that for any non-zero value of M and R, this theory breaks supersymmetry. Okay, that's clear because to set this term to zero, phi plus and phi minus have to both be zero, but then there's an R squared here, or to set this term to zero, they can't both be zero, and then this is not zero. Now, unlike the Polanyi model, one of the reasons why I like this model is that here the vacuum is stable even before you consider radiative corrections. Although it's a very simple theory, it doesn't have the same flat direction. So for instance, in the regime where the D term R is of order string scale or is large, you can just solve for the vacuum. Basically, phi plus turns on to cancel the D term energy, phi minus stays at zero, and the superpotential then gives phi minus a big F term of order M square root of R. Now, this is a vector-like gauge theory, just phi plus and phi minus. So the small mass a priori looks unnatural. It's not protected by a symmetry. On the other hand, it is natural in this technical sense that if absent at tree level, it can only be generated by non-perturbative effects due to the non-renormalization theorem that we quoted. So this is a toy model, but it's similar in many ways to the way that ISS uses a small quark mass to generate a low scale of Susy breaking. You put in the small mass, the scale is low. Now what I'm going to do here is describe how in simple D-brain constructions, precisely this model or the previous one is realized, but in a way where an exponentially small Susy breaking scale is actually obtained naturally from a stringy instanton effect. Okay? So the field theory dynamics is trivial. This model doesn't look like it would do anything interesting, but string theory can fix that up. So I'll start with the basic idea and then I'll get more and more complicated. The basic idea is simple. Brains at singularities or intersecting brains give rise quite generally to quiver gauge theories. The quiver that we need for the Phi A model is the most trivial quiver you could imagine. You need two nodes, which I've labeled 2 and 3 for a reason that will become clear. And we need one arrow going between the nodes both ways. Okay, then one of the U1s, if we have a U1 times U1 theory, decouples because nothing is charged under it, and the other has a charge plus and a charge minus. So our basic idea is the following. Let's consider some non-compact Calabi-Yau space, which contains a few 2 cycles that give that quiver, on which space-filling D5 brains are wrapped. But let's imagine this Calabi-Yau, like most Calabi-Yaus, also has other geometry. For instance, a third 2-cycle, which is not wrapped by either of the 5 brains, so it supports no space-filling gauge group. Then there would be 2 chiral multiplets of charges plus minus under the U1 gauge groups. So the sum of the U1s decouples, the difference is the U1 of the Phi model. But in this quiver theory, and I'll show you such a quiver, the superpotential is zero perturbatively into all orders, but a Euclidean D1 brain wrapping on the cycle that has nothing to do with the gauge theory, the third curve C, will contribute an instanton effect with precisely the right zero mode structure to generate phi plus phi minus. This can't be interpreted as an ordinary field theory instanton. There's no field theory associated with the cycle that the instanton wraps, and there's no non-abelian gauge dynamics anywhere in the system. This is a U1 theory. Now also, I should say, this is not an advertisement, it's an admission, that I'm working in a non-compact Calabi-Yau. So if you can engineer such a gauge theory, M and R are fixed parameters at the level of my discussion. They arise from non-normalizable modes in the geometry, and of course, in any real compactification, they would become dynamical, and you'd have to worry about their dynamics too. Okay, so how do I find this arising at a singularity? So I'll start simple and I'll get more and more complicated. The way to get the quiver I just mentioned is to generalize the conifold. So you know the conifold gives a pretty similar quiver to what I wrote, that's xy equals ew. A simple generalization of the conifold is to quotient by zn. That gives xy to the n equals zw, and this arises in many compact Calabi-Yaus. Now, the gauge theories on D3 brains and fractional D5 brains in type 2b, if you bring them up to the singularity, were worked out by Yuranga many years ago. So for a given n, the quiver has two n nodes, and there are non-chiral arrows going between adjacent nodes, like that. And you can see that the n equals one limit is indeed the standard conical and quiver where these arrows go back around. Now, there is also a superpotential. Between any set of nodes, you can make a quartic that goes here and then goes back. So the tree-level superpotential actually takes this form of a sum of all such quartics going around the circle, which again generalizes the conifold. And you can verify that if you probe this thing with a probe D3 brain, it gives you n copies of the conifold geometry, as you'd expect. Now, these theories are completely non-chiral, so unlike some quivers, in this quiver, any occupation numbers are allowed at the various nodes. So in particular, in this picture, if I just took nodes 2 and 3 and put 1 5 brain on them and left all the other nodes empty, I'd get precisely the model I wrote down before. Okay, that would be the phi A model up to a decoupled D1. Now, the Euclidean D brain I'm going to be interested in, we'll wrap this node, which has nothing to do with the gauge group. I could also wrap that node. Now, a Euclidean D brain, if it's a one brain wrapping a holomorphic curve, breaks half of the supersymmetry. Now, the interesting thing about this D instanton is that although it has nothing to do with the field theory, it actually has massless Ramone sector open strings that connect the D instanton to the fractional D brain on the adjacent node. So if the D instanton wraps this node, it actually has Ramone sector strings connecting it to this node. Now, you can capture this with an extended quiver diagram. So here the square node is the instanton. There are no space-filling brains wrapping that node, so I put a zero there. And these are the two field theory nodes. So here are the field theory fields. But these alpha and beta are so-called Ganor strings, because they were first discussed by Ori Ganor. They connect the instanton to node 2. Now, there are various subtleties that you have to deal with when you consider instanton calculations in the presence of various fermion zero modes. Well, I guess I'm cutting off the right hand of the screen there. Okay. So the first is, these instantons have been considered by many groups, one at Stanford with Fourier et al., including me, and then some groups in Germany and in Spain. And they have many interesting applications. Mine will be to Susie breaking, but there are subtleties in any of the applications. The first is these Ganor strings, of course, aren't free. They have couplings in their action. Just like you could write a quartic coupling between field theory nodes, there's in fact a quartic coupling that goes like that. So the instanton action includes a factor of alpha xx beta. Now, what that means is if you perform the integral over the instanton collective coordinates, which you have to, in addition to whatever you normally get, you're going to pull down a factor of x2, x3, because you pull down whatever the alpha and beta are multiplying. So if this generates any term, it will be proportional to x2, x3, e to the minus area, where area is the area of the curve the instanton wraps.
Like x2, 3 times x3, 2, right?
Yes.
So you don't need any axions charged?
You do not need any axions to shift. In other applications, in fact, there are axions that shift, and there's an anomalous U1. This is a different application. Okay, the second point is that although naively, as I said, the instanton breaks half of the space-time supersymmetry, which was preserved by the space-filling brains, locally, in its own sector of open strings that stretch from the instanton to itself, the ED1, ED1 sector, at leading order, it doesn't know that the other brains are present. You quantize those strings, and they don't know about the other D brains. So it actually thinks, this is a little heuristic, but it thinks that it's breaking half of the n equals 2 supersymmetry of a Calabi-Yau, not half of the n equals 1 supersymmetry of a Calabi-Yau with brains. Now, that's bad, because there's danger that if you're breaking half of n equals 2 supersymmetry, you'll have 4 fermion zero modes. You act with the broken supercharges on the instanton, they generate fermion zero modes, and half of n equals 2 gives you 4 zero modes. Now, that's too many to correct the spacetime superpotential, for which you need precisely 2 zero modes. Yeah?
Brain, what's the volume of the cycle it breaks?
So, of course.
I mean, what's the volume he tracks? Sorry?
What is the volume of the size?
So, of course, in a Quiver theory, that's controlled by some features in the geometry. For literally the instanton I'm talking about, it's actually not even the volume. It's a combination of a B field and a Ramon-Ramon field over G string. Okay? And the... Yeah,
exactly.
So it's BNS plus BRR over G string. And the reason the action is large, if you want, is because G string is small.
Why are you considering world sheet instanton effects?
World sheet instanton effects in this model, okay, depending on how you make your compact Calabi-Yau models, or even non-compact ones, when D instantons are projected in as BPS objects, world sheet instantons are often projected out, and vice versa. Okay, because you keep some subset of the axions and some subset of the Kähler moduli. So I'm imagining here a projection that keeps this quiver, which would mean it's kept the moduli that couples to the D instanton and not the world sheet instanton. Now, here you could tell some story. Perhaps in some cases the extra zero modes are lifted by interactions with background flux generated by brains. I don't want to do that. I'll just give you a trivial and explicit way to get the correct zero mode counting, and then I'll give you another one later. And that's to just put an orientifold plane on the node wrapped by the instanton. Okay, then that literally projects out half of the ED1 Ramon sector ground states and gives you the two that are required for correction to W. And I'll verify this in various ways later. Now, such orientifolds of these quivers are easy to construct. They leave our gauge theory completely untouched. All they do is they allow the Euclidean D-branch control. So the end result is that this stupid quiver with just a U1 times U1 gauge group and a phi plus and a phi minus and this one instanton with a square node being this Euclidean brain actually generates the phi A model, but with an exponentially small Suzy breaking scale. So the leading order theory has no superpotential. The superpotential is generated by the D1 instanton on this node. It's proportional to e to the minus area, so m is naturally small. And so the F term in this phi A model goes like m root r, which even for Planck scale r, or string scale r, is parametrically smaller than m Planck. So the r is, again, in these quivers, it's just a parameter in the geometry. So in other words, to borrow the parlance of Dienfeng and Silverstein, string theory automatically retrofits one of the sort of old classic toy models of Suzy breaking to make it a model of dynamical Suzy breaking. You don't need non-abelian gauge groups, you don't need QCD, you don't even need dimensional transmutation. You just stick in a model with two particles, and string theory makes it dynamical Suzy breaking. Now, there are many dual views of this particular model. My point isn't that this model is so great, you can make many models, but we might as well study this one. Here's one dual view. Instead of having a conifold with as many nodes, you can make alternate nodes, D4 brains, stretching between NS and NS prime brains. Those of you who are old enough to remember Hanani-Witten constructions will see this immediately. So an NS brain wraps 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. An NS prime wraps 0, 1, 2, 3, 8, 9. And they're separated on the x6 direction. And then stretching D4s between them gives the same theory that I've discussed here, with phi plus and phi minus arising from strings going across this NS prime brain. Now, it's natural to ask, though no one has done so yet, what happens if the instanton effects generate additional field theory operators? Okay, I told you one instanton that does one thing, but you should probably include all effects. Now, I should say here, in view of common sense, that simple dimensional analysis shows that if higher powers of phi plus, phi minus are generated, those are the only gauge invariant things, they appear with additional powers of M string as suppression, because there's no other scale. So there could be other terms that look like this. My claim, based on common sense, would be that they would be negligible in the vicinity of the vacuum, but we don't need to use common sense, because in a minute I'll derive the exact sum for you by using geometric transitions. Okay? So those of you who don't want to be sensible, be patient. Now, let me go back to a simpler model. It's actually easy to see how to make quivers that would generate any of the other kind of classic models and their generalizations, but automatically being retrofitted to be quote-unquote realistic, to have exponentially small scale. So for instance, for the Polonyi model, consider the one-node quiver with a U1. But arrange the U1 to have an adjoint. So it's U1 with an adjoint. In other words, the theory of a single scalar field. As long as there's another node with the right structure of Ramoned arrows from the instanton that wraps that node to this U1, there will be an alpha x beta coupling, and the instanton effect on node 1 will actually generate a Polonyi model with exponentially small coefficient. Now, that quiver I just wrote down, but it's actually trivial to engineer based on the quiver I already told you about. Okay, so I'll do this in the 2A language. You could do it in the 2B language. You start with this Hanani-Witten type construction, which gave you the Faye model, and you just take this NS prime brain and just move it off. So the D4 is now stretched between two NS brains. There's one D4 between two NS brains. It can move in the 4-5 direction. That's the adjoint X. And the instanton, which is a zero brain going between here and here, generates the superpotential I told you about. So this would actually give, as I said, a retrofitted Polonyi model. Now, I told you before that you should worry when somebody hands you a Polonyi model that it has a flat direction, so it's kind of a fake. You don't know that Susie is really broken in the true vacuum. But here's a way to see that in this particular model, at least for some range of parameters, there would be a stable vacuum. It's that you can realize the Polonyi model is a limit of the Phi model, which actually corresponds to the limit where I move the NS prime brain off. That is, if you take the Fi term to be very large, you don't really have to make it infinite, make it unstring, while holding m root r fixed, then you can quickly convince yourself by integrating out fields that the Phi model is a Polonyi model with a linear superpotential mu squared x, where x is made of Phi minus. So the U1 becomes very massive because you have a large Fi term. You get a free U1 theory with the singlet Phi minus, and you can compute the stabilizing mass explicitly. It goes like mu squared over root r. So it's small. This would not be realistic. It would have cosmological trouble, but it shows you how to make even this model with a stable vacuum. Of course, in the string construction, you can't really take r to infinity. You should keep it smaller than the string scale, but that's fine. Okay, now I'll give you one more model just because it's so easy you can write it down over lunch in 5 minutes, which is an O'Rafferty model. This is just to finish off the classic simplest models. My O'Rafferty model will be kind of a fake. There are better ones than this one. This one will still have a flat direction. Okay. So the simplest O'Rafferty model I could make with the same quiver has a U1 gauge group and 4 chiral multiplets with equal and opposite charges, phi phi tilde, and 2 chiral multiplets that are neutral. So there's x and x tilde. They both couple to phi phi tilde. But you then shift the x tilde coupling by mu squared in order to arrange that the x and x tilde f terms cannot be simultaneously satisfied. Right? This one wants phi phi tilde to be 0. This wants it to be minus mu squared. So that's basically the kind of thing O'Rafferty models do. In this particular model, because there was a U1, there's a D-term constraint. The phi squared minus phi tilde squared is r. Now, in the limit where mu squared goes to 0, where these F-terms become consistent, there would be a supersymmetric vacuum where you set one of the phis to be non-zero and set the other to 0. So just given this structure, it's clear what we want to do. We want to write a quiver where mu squared is generated dynamically by a string instanton. So again, we can do this with just 2D brains. Here's the quiver. U1 times U1, there's an adjoint, and there are arrows between the two nodes of the quiver. And if you wrap an instanton on node 1, there will be a coupling alpha, that beta. Okay, those play the role of alpha, that beta, and that plays the role of the x tilde field. So as long as the Ganor strings have the right coupling, the D instanton on node 1 will generate the exponentially small mu squared. Now, these have been the sort of simplest models. They're kind of fun to play with. But we're serious people and we'd like to do something non-trivial. So now what I'm going to do, though, like I said, it's kind of overkill for the application, is try to give a classical description of the same thing that doesn't involve any instantons at all, but that will, in fact, sum the whole series of instantons via geometric transitions. So geometric transitions, you know, can be used to recast instanton superpotentials in terms of flux superpotentials. So here's the standard 2B flux formula. You take the Ramon-Ramon 3 form, the NS 3 form, you wedge it with omega, and that gives you a superpotential. And like I said, here the bonus will be, if you care about counting instantons, this will sum up all the multi-instanton contributions. So I'm going to do this in a family of geometries that actually Freddy with Captain Vafa described first in this context. These are AR vibrations over some x-plane. So the AR singularity looks like UV equals z to the r plus 1. And we let z how to say, we let the precise resolution of the AR singularity vary over the x-plane. So you've got a family of AR singularities. So this family has RP1s, the RP1s of the AR singularity, whose volumes can be independently dialed. And a given two-sphere, the ith two-sphere, arises by blowing up the locus where Zi is equal to Zi plus 1. Now, if we wrap D-brains on these spheres, you get a quiver that's a close relative of the ones I've already talked about. The gauge theory that we find has a field content given by adjoints phi I, one for each two-sphere. You should think of these adjoints as parameterizing the position of a five-brain wrapped on the two-sphere over the x-plane. And by fundamentals between the adjacent spheres qi, I plus 1, and qi plus 1, I. So this is exactly like the quivers I've been discussing before, but they're adjoints. And the superpotential is a standard n equals 2-like superpotential that couples quarks to the adjoints. Okay, so that would be present in an n equals 2 theory. And then some individual superpotentials for each of the adjoints, which I'll tell you about in a second. So again, the adjoints just parameterize positions of d5 brains on the x-plane. Now, the superpotential for each adjoint is also something that's completely classical. There's a nice formula due to Witten that says that given a curve C, given a three-cycle C whose boundary is the curve that the five-brain wraps, the superpotential for the five-brain is just the integral of omega over this chain C. Now, for the class of geometries at hand, you can actually prove easily, I think they probably did it, but we also did it in our appendix, that this simplifies greatly if the singularity had some parameter zi of x in it over the x-plane, then in fact the ith adjoint superpotential is just given by integrating zi of x minus zi plus 1 of x and interpreting the resulting function as a function of the adjoint. Again, completely classical. So consider, for instance, this geometry. Okay, we take z1 to be mx, z2 to be minus mx, x minus 2a. And let's just wrap, so this has three different cycles in it, it's an A3. Let's wrap one brain on each of the three two-spheres. Okay, so it's a U1 cube theory, very fancy. There are more general cases that work, but this is the sort of most modest choice. If we wrapped an O-plane on node 3 instead of a D-brain, that would also work, I'll mention that later, and it would be directly analogous to what I was doing before. So I'm changing the story a little. So what's the superpotential? We have the U1s. There are three adjoints, phi1, phi2, and phi3, and there are these n equals 2-like couplings of the quarks to the adjoints at either end of the nodes they stretch between. And then there's some WIs that we get by subtracting this from this, and this from this, and this from this, and integrating. So those WIs are trivially computed, and in fact I chose this geometry so they would just be quadratic. The first one gives m phi1 squared, the second gives m phi2 squared, and the third gives m phi3 minus a squared. And this phi3 minus a comes because I shifted that by 2a. And it tells us that the third five-brain is localized elsewhere on the x-plane from the first two. Now, that's the important point, that the third node is localized elsewhere. So it has a massive adjoint, massive because this is a quadratic coupling that's localized at a. But it also has only massive quarks, because they have to stretch between this five-brain and the other two over some non-trivial distance. So that means that this node 3, this 1-5-brain, actually has a completely massive world volume theory. Now, one thing that we've learned over the last 5 years, or more like 8 years, is in various situations where you're left with completely massive theories on D-brains, the correct thing to do is perform a geometric transition. If the theory is massive, there's no need to have a D-brain there at all. There should be a description just from geometry. So let's do that. Let's perform a geometric transition. This results in a deformed geometry where the beginning of the equation is the same, but after transitioning node 3, I've shifted the geometry by a parameter s, which is, if you want, like the deformation parameter of the deformed conifold. Okay, locally these are conifold-like singularities in a sense. So the picture that you should have in mind is that locally, that massive node had an S3 and an S2 in it. We were in the phase where the S2 was of finite size and we were wrapping the S2. After the transition, the S2 has shrunk, the S3 is now big, and the 5-brain is replaced by a Ramon flux through the new S3, the A cycle, There's also a dual three sphere through which you can thread an S-flux. So the transition weaves you with a geometry where the third five grain is gone. There's one unit of RR flux. The NS flux is not quantized in the non-compact geometry. And in fact, its value maps by duality to the gauge coupling parameter of the old five grain theory. Now, we're left with a completely classical computation. We have these superpotentials that came from integrating the holomorphic three form, and we have a flux superpotential. And the periods of the three form that you need to compute this flux superpotential are completely standard in this geometry. The A cycle period is S. The B cycle period is S log S up to a shift. Here, delta is a regulator that regulates the size of the cycle. And big S is just little s over M. So little s was the deformation of the defining equation. Now, in addition to this flux superpotential that we'll compute using these periods, there's been one other change, which is that although the third node is gone, when we deform the equation, we change W2 of phi, because it's given by differences of the z's. So the total superpotential now, node 3 is gone, so there's some W1 of phi1, W2 of phi2 and S, because it depends on the deformation, these N equals 2 like couplings, and some flux superpotential. And the flux superpotential is just the standard Veneziano-Yankelevich form. It's T times S plus S log S. Completely standard. Like I said, the other change is W2 tilde, which is given by integrating Z2 minus Z3 tilde, has now changed. So I define Z3 tilde, then use Z3, by requiring that putting the equation in this form, we should get Z minus the old Z3, Z minus the old Z4, minus S. Okay, so you can asymptotically solve this equation so that at large Z3, Z3 tilde looks like the old Z3. Sorry, so at large X, Z3 tilde looks like the old Z3. So that's easy to solve, it takes 1 minute. And the result is this complicated looking formula for W2 tilde. Now you integrate from delta to X of this difference between the ZIs. Now, if you think about what this is doing, even without computing it, how would you compute this? You would Taylor expand in little s, compute it term by term, and it'll actually turn out that the nth term, the nth power of s, is actually an n-instanton effect in the original theory. So this superpotential is actually summing up the instanton effects due to arbitrary numbers of Euclidean D1 grains wrapping the curve before the transition. So we can now solve for all the fields given our superpotential, and for the locations of the five grains in the x-plane. I won't go through the algebra. Here's the result. It's not surprising. S is exponentially small. It goes like e to the minus t tilde over gs. T tilde is the old bare gauge coupling shifted by a log. This log is not a surprise. It's the one loop running due to the fact that there are quarks that are massive. And phi1 and phi2 can be solved for in terms of the quark fields. Here are their values. Note that phi2 is indeed shifted by S a little bit. Now, all omitted terms are higher orders in small parameters. I'm not writing out the full instanton series, so I'll ignore terms that are more suppressed in that or more suppressed in that. But the low energy effective superpotential we get is then some quartic, which is technically irrelevant, and a mass term that's exponentially small. Okay, so in this limit where I ignored the multi-instanton effects, up to this irrelevant quartic, this is again the phi model. Now it's been retrofitted classically. You have some d-brains in a classical geometry. There's a flux. The flux induces an exponentially small mass term and results in Susie breaking. But although this is dynamical Susie breaking in a real sense, it's completely classical. Now, again, the merit of this picture compared to the previous one that I gave you with instantons is that we can classically and explicitly compute the full series of instanton corrections. Okay, so we compute it up to 6 or something in our appendix. But as promised, application of common sense guaranteed that the higher corrections do nothing to the Susie breaking vacuum, and application of brute force, in fact, confirms common sense. Now, I should note here, there's a nice connection with work done in the context of the old Dijkgraaf-Pfaffe matrix model. We could have done exactly the same thing with an O5 plane wrapping node 3 instead of a D5 ring. It would have to be SP type, because otherwise the projection on the instanton wouldn't remove the Ramon zero modes correctly. And in fact, after the geometric transition, precisely these SP-type O5 planes are known to generate flux superpotentials. In this paper by Introgator, Kraus, Reza, Shigemori, and Vafa, that was trying to sort out very low-end cases of Dijkstra-Vafa. Now, the absence of the instanton effect, if instead we had an empty third node, or if we had an SO-type or antipole there, is clear from the transition picture also, as argued by these authors. So the criteria in the transition classical geometry and the criteria in the instanton computation line up perfectly. Okay, now why am I talking about this? My point wasn't really that you can make these three old models in string theory. You can make many more by the same techniques. But what you'd really like to do, if you were ambitious or misguided, is to find a way to use these very simple models in combination with one of these realizations of the MSSM that people talk about, and try to transmit the Susie breaking to the MSSM. And the merit of these models is instead of having some huge machine that generates a non-abelian group that does dynamics with a large stack of D-brains, you need to add one D-brain to the geometry. It's very simple. Now, if you were not afraid of the Susie flavor problem, this problem that squarks are probably very degenerate, what you'd probably do is just add one of these sectors somewhere in the geometry. There's one cycle wrapped by a brain, and let gravity mediation do the work for you. This seems to be a common attitude in Europe. But I actually am afraid of the Susie flavor problem, so I'm not going to do that. Now, an idea that people think is elegant in New Jersey is to use gauge mediation. This, of course, often ruins unification and ruins the dark matter candidate, but maybe it's true. So very roughly, if you wanted to do that, what would you try to imagine? Well, you'd imagine a quiver where all the hard part is left here in a hidden node. Okay, so this is a standard model. Don't ask me how you got that into one node. Okay, then here we have, like my Phi A model, here's a stringy instanton. It generates the Susie breaking in the Phi A model. That's then transmissioned to the standard model, transmitted to the standard model by these messengers that stretch between nodes 3 and 4. Note that as long as the mass of these messengers is large compared to the Susie breaking scale, they won't affect the dynamics that I talked about. And that's what you want in gauge mediation. Now, in fact, actually that quiver, but if this was a U1, so I could really make it, I have no idea how to make the standard model, I'm not one of those people. The stringy instanton here would also play an interesting role. It would generate a mass for the messengers. So you could explain why the messengers are massive, and you could also explain why their mass is much less than the Planck scale, which also happens in gauge mediation. So if you wanted to extend the standard model by a U1, you might actually be able to use such quivers to give messengers and small masses to the messengers and try to transmit Susie breaking with the U1. But such models typically have various diseases. Now, another interesting possibility, which is fashionable at Johns Hopkins and Harvard, would be to instead embed our quiver theories at the end of a warped geometry. Okay, these are, after all, D-brains wrapping cycles or flux superpotentials. They naturally come with warping. And if you imagined putting these at the end of a renormalization group cascade in the field theory language, then the picture would be there's some throat, at the end there's our one D-brain that breaks supersymmetry, and Susie breaking is transmitted up the throat. So the standard model is off here somewhere in the bulk of the Clavier. Now, the only point here is to advertise that actually in very related theories, we actually have explicitly constructed these RG cascades that end with the simple theories I described, and we can actually see in that picture a third way to compute the stringy instanton effect. So I showed you an instanton way, I showed you a geometric transition way. There's a third way here, which is once you add the RG cascade, the gauge group does become non-abelian. You can solve the theory using cybergology. Okay, you can solve for the dynamics of the non-abelian theory, and you can actually reproduce the stringy instanton as a gauge theory effect at higher steps in the cascade. But then you've kind of lost the simplicity. Now, the point about having such a throat, why did I have the throat here at all, other than as an excuse to have this picture? Well, the point is that with Sundrum and my student McAllister, we were able to show that when you break Susie at the end of such throats, the breaking is what's called sequestered, which really just means that the dangerous dimension 6 operators giving squarks flavor non-universal masses don't occur. So this is a precondition for what's called anomaly mediation, and you might be able to make models of anomaly mediation in this context. To do that, again, if you're a serious person, you need a cure for the tachyonics leptons of anomaly mediation. there are, you know, a standard list of things you could say about that, but you're not model builders, so I won't. Okay, well, this talk has been completely trivial, and I'm ready to finish. What are the directions for further work? Well, the thing I like about these models is they require only one or two D-brains and some appropriate geometry that has Euclidean instantons, which essentially all Calabi-Yaz do. So there should be many, many simple avatars, some simpler than the singularities I mentioned, and there have been papers already by Verlinda et al., by Kumar. There's another one a few days ago that generalize these things to other geometries that may be more realistic. For model building, you should extend this idea to include mediation to a standard model. The thing I'm actually working on now is forgetting any application to Susie breaking. There should be a general understanding of Euclidean brains and quivers that could parallel our understanding of space-filling brains and quivers that comes from the derived category. And that general formalism that would apply to any quiver hasn't been worked out yet. But I think for Calabi-Yaz singularities, you can work that out, and I'm trying to do that now with many people. And then finally, if you were serious about applications, I think it would be eminently worthwhile to design similar simple theories in the corners of the landscape, like the heterotic string, that naturally accommodate gauge coupling unification. And I bet over, you know, a coffee break, you could figure out how to do the same thing that I was doing with D instantons using world sheet instantons in the heterotic string. So that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Just out of curiosity, do you have an extra you want to the standard model, one of the models?
Well, that was very sketchy, but yes.
I was wondering if you could communicate Susie breaking by kinetic mixing to the standard.
This is a great question. So there will be an author of this paper that's going to appear, but there's going to be a paper shortly by Herman Verlinda and some of his collaborators. Where he argues, so I mentioned to you that I had worked with Sundrum trying to show that you could do sequestering of Susie breaking if you had a warped throat and broke Susie at the end of the throat, either with one of these theories, with an anti-brain, whatever. Herman is going to claim that in that circumstance, you're left with the normal problem of anomaly mediation. But if you now assume that there's also a U1 at the end that has kinetic mixing with the standard model, then the U1, you can get U1 mediation, which typically has an opposite problem to anomaly mediation. Typically, in U1 mediation, the squarks end up too light, and the sleptons are too heavy. And the U1 mediation can fix the tachyonic sleptons, while anomaly mediation gives a mass to the squarks. So, yeah, as people are working on that. I'm not the right person to ask about it.
Questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.